It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A new study finds that in order to avoid potential repercussions at work and at home, many women opt to stay behind the scenes at work, which can cost them promotions and raises. In this hour of the morning show, we'll discuss the research with one of the study's authors. Women, we want to hear from you. Do you work in a male-dominated field? What has your experience been? Have you been in that field for a long time? How have things changed over the years? Do you avoid being too assertive or authoritative at work, even if that's part of your personality outside the office? How does that express itself in your family life? Employers, what do you do to make sure women feel comfortable at work? Have you taken steps to make sure traits like emotional intelligence, willingness to collaborate, and giving others credit are valued as much as confidence and assertiveness? Let us know. Tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Devin Magliozzi, a PhD candidate in sociology at Stanford University. She's co-author of the study Intentional Invisibility, Professional Women and the Navigation of Workplace Constraints. Devin Magliozzi, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks, John. It's great to be with you.
In your study, you talk about this idea of intentional invisibility. Can you define what that is?
Absolutely. So intentional invisibility is a set of strategies we found women using in the workplace to avoid conflict, to minimize the risk that they face. And so this is taking opportunities to actually step out of the spotlight, stay behind the scenes, and act in ways that they won't face repercussions for.
What does that actually look like? What are some examples of women engaging in this behavior?
Some examples would be not speaking up at a meeting, even if you have something to add to the conversation. Or after you face a negative comment from a colleague, it would be minimizing that comment. So one example is from a software engineer who worked in the IT division of the organization that we studied. She had a lot of expertise as a computer scientist. She had advanced degrees. She had a lot of experience in her position. But when she would walk into conference rooms for meetings, more than one time, men around the table would assume that she was a secretary who was there to take notes. So she says that at first, when this would happen, she would be really upset about it. But over time, she developed this coping strategy where she came to get a kick out of it. She decided it was pretty funny and that she just needed to do what she had to do to advance as the professional she wanted to be. She decided not to let it stress her out and not to call attention to the incident, which would make her stand out as a woman in her male-dominated field.
This was a long study. It was 2.5 years. Looking back at it, are there any anecdotes about particular women that really stand out for you?
Oh, there were so many. I don't think we have time to dive into all of them. Like you said, we followed a lot of women. But one that really stuck out to me and my colleagues was a story that a woman shared about one of her colleagues who left the office on maternity leave on a Tuesday. On Wednesday, she had a baby. And by the next Monday, she was back in the office. And when Jane saw this happen, she wondered about her colleague. Did she come back because she just loves the work? Did she come back because she just felt like she was up to it? In some ways, Jane was impressed and thought that the colleague was really doing something difficult and showing a lot of strength. But at the end of the day, she thought her colleague might have come back because she felt like she had to compete as a woman. She didn't want to stand out as somebody who had had a baby. And so even though maternity leave was available at the organization, she took a grand total of 4 days out of the office.
Yeah, that actually sounds familiar to me. What made you want to study this issue in the first place? What brought it to your attention?
I think this was something that other scholars, other studies had shown, was that women face a double bind at work when it comes to visibility. So we know that one of the most important things you need to do at work in order to be promoted is make yourself visible. You need to be seen, having the kinds of skills that a leader or a manager should have. And you just need to be known to the people who are making promotion decisions or hiring decisions. But it's not so straightforward for women. We saw that women knew that they should be more visible and that they needed to be promoted, but also knew that if they were more visible, they might face backlash. So we wanted to figure out what women were doing to navigate this double bind. And we thought that following women through a professional development program where they talked for 2 years about their experiences in these kinds of situations would be a great way to observe that.
How has the release of your study findings been received? What kind of feedback have you been getting?
It's been not exactly surprising, but in some ways disappointing to hear stories from so many women who weren't involved in the study, but who can relate to it. We've gotten a lot of stories from people across the country, from our personal networks, our professional networks, people who just happened to read the story, who feel that they've had experiences very similar to the ones we described.
And was there any pushback on the study? Were there people who said, "No, this isn't really what's happening," or tried to dismiss it in some way?
We actually haven't really faced any pushback at this point. I suppose we'll see what kinds of questions and experiences callers bring today.
Well, that's a reminder for me to give the phone number again, 800-642-1234, if you want to join our discussion. Tell us your story at work, what have you been seeing? So you're thinking, though, maybe some you'll get more comments as the study becomes more well-known.
Yeah, it is fairly new. And so far, the response has been overwhelmingly positive and feeling like it resonates.
I hesitated to share this earlier because it's a personal story for me, but this was a long time ago, when my wife had our second child, she went back to work 2 days after the birth. And it was because there was no maternity leave where she was working, and we needed the money at that time, and so she went back to work right away. Neither one of us was happy about it. I guess where that leads me is going back to your example of the anecdote of the woman who came back 4 days after the birth of her child, even though there was maternity leave. What role do significant others play in this, or can they play in this?
I think partners and spouses we found play a really significant role. So in the example you bring up, one of the things that happens is it looks like women are making a free choice when really they're choosing from a bad set of options. So even if they have a supportive partner, even if their workplace offers maternity leave, they might not really feel free to take up that option, knowing that they'll face backlash if they do. But one thing that we saw time and again in the study is that when partners weren't supportive, when partners were reinforcing the kind of backlash that women were facing at work, they were much more likely to seek invisibility in the workplace. One example that was really striking came from a woman who is pretty early in her career, who, through the professional development program that we were observing, had really started to feel more empowered and more ambitious in her career. She wanted to learn new skills and take on new roles, and she felt fantastic about it. But one day when she went home, she noticed that her husband had been kind of irritable with her. And she said to him, "Did I do something?" And he said to her, "I don't even know who you are anymore. You're making all of these plans. You're talking about going back to school. You're doing this and that, and you're not present. You're not here for us." So she said she realized in that moment, "I guess there's a reality." So in an ideal scenario, a partner can be a really supportive person who's helping balance the risk for women who want to take more reach positions at work. But more often what we saw was partners who were reinforcing the negative stereotypes they were facing at the workplace.
We want to hear stories from listeners. and what you have to say. It seems, well, I don't want to start another discussion here. We have to take a break for news, but it almost seems, I'd like to talk about this maybe after the news break, it almost seems like women have to change their identities to be more bold in the workplace. They have to become a different person than the one they are. Maybe that's not the right question, but let's talk about it anyway after the news. Want to hear your stories about what it's like for you in the workplace as a woman. Do you make yourself invisible? Do you try not to be the nail sticking up? Do you try not to be assertive or make your points? What's your story? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're talking about new research suggesting that many women adopt a strategy of intentional invisibility at work. My guest is Devin Magliozzi, a PhD candidate in sociology at Stanford University, co-author of the Intentional Invisibility Study. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A new two-year-long study finds that in order to avoid potential repercussions at work and at home, many women opt to stay behind the scenes on the job, which can cost them promotions and raises. We're talking about the research with one of the study's authors and with you. If you care to join us, share your workplace stories with us this hour. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Devin Magliozzi, a PhD candidate in sociology at Stanford University, co-author of the study titled Intentional Invisibility, Professional Women and the Navigation of Workplace Constraints. So before the news break, I guess the question I would have for you that I asked then, I want to ask it again, is it do women just basically have to change their identities in order to become more bold in the workplace, or how does this work?
In a word, no. I think one of the things we saw a lot is that when women were bold in the workplace, they faced negative consequences. So the solution here is not, as a lot of professional development coaches would have it, for women to be more assertive. As an example of that, one of the participants in the professional development program we were watching, she had learned these tactics to kind of take up more space and speak more loudly in meetings through the program. And then she went to a meeting where she spoke up, and as she was walking out, a man she worked with said, "God, I'm glad I'm not married to you." So Sharon's takeaway was, wow, I was really projecting a lot of sternness in that meeting, and she decided to scale it back. And that's the kind of thing we saw over and over again, that women were often comfortable being bold. They were confident. They wanted to speak up and be more assertive. But if they did, they faced backlash. So what we would advocate for is that organizations actually need to change rather than women themselves. Just being more assertive and fitting masculine stereotypes is not going to help women get ahead.
We have a caller. Mike is with us from Madison. Mike, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Morning. Thank you. I'd like to raise the topic of whether this study or other studies maybe would evaluate whether women in the workplace are inclined to not rock the boat at work. In other words, you know, not bring stuff up that may, you know, make employers feel edgy, anxious, or something, that whatever. That they did something wrong, maybe.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for your call, Devin. What do you think of what Mike had to say there?
I think that's absolutely right. One of the primary reasons that we saw women using intentional invisibility was so that they would avoid conflict, so that they would stay likable to their employers and their colleagues, and not bring up things that were going to create conflict.
And men don't have that problem.
men tend to be rewarded in the workplace when they're assertive or when they voice their opinions. It's seen as a sign of confidence and sometimes a sign of competence. So they don't face the same likability penalty that women in the workplace do.
Intentional invisibility isn't just about women in entry level or lower level positions, though, is it? I mean, did you find in your study that it's also about women who are already in leadership or management positions?
Yes, actually, the women in our study really ran the gamut from entry level, kind of more administrative positions to really high management positions within the organization. And we saw this across the board. One of the things we saw at the higher levels was that women would redefine leadership to fit with the kinds of behaviors they were being rewarded for within their division of the company. So for example, one woman told us that she was really uncomfortable with the word leadership until she was able to redefine it for herself, even though she was in a leadership position. One of her colleagues said that oftentimes the things associated with leaders are cold and rational instead of compelling or passionate or interesting. So she too redefined the traits she associated with a good leader to be closer to the kinds of things she was being responded to well before.
So let's talk about what the consequences are for intentional invisibility for the women who choose to engage that strategy. Let's just in general terms, what are the consequences of this strategy?
One of the big issues is that women will be looked over for promotion. Our study didn't evaluate this directly, but we know from other research that visibility is one of the most important criteria that managers look for when deciding who to consider for a promotion. So if women are being penalized when they're visible, and if they're avoiding visibility as a result, they're not going to be the people who are noticed when a promotion becomes available.
And what about for the workplace as a whole? Not just the individuals engaging in the strategy, but for the workplace as a whole, what are the consequences there?
Well, one of the clearest ones, and I think the most disappointing for us to watch as researchers, was what a toll this took on women in positions where they felt like they couldn't speak up and couldn't be themselves. Women felt like they were pushed into behaviors that really didn't feel authentic, that didn't feel consistent with their values or their personalities, and it created a lot of strain for them, both with their colleagues, with their supervisors, with the teams they supervise, and oftentimes with their partners at home.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join our discussion this morning on the Ideas Network. You can also send us an email. The address is ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking with Devin Magliozzi, who is one of the co-authors of a study titled Intentional Invisibility, Professional Women and the Navigation of Workplace Constraints. We want to hear your stories of the workplace. What have you seen that looks like this kind of behavior? Have you engaged in it yourself intentionally, or maybe when you think about it, maybe you didn't even really think about it, you just did it? If you're an employer, does this resonate with you? Have you taken steps to make sure that people feel comfortable, that women feel comfortable having opinions and being involved, not being invisible in your company? What have you done? If there's a strategy there, we want to hear your stories. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're starting to get some callers. We'll take a few of those in just a moment. Are there any benefits for women who choose to kind of stay behind the scenes at work? Are there examples of where the strategy actually pays off?
It depends really on how you define benefits. So we don't think that women are making a bad choice per se. What they're doing is choosing the most secure route out of a bad set of options. So if women are faced with the decision to either risk losing their professional status by facing backlash or to maintain their professional status by trying to stay out of the spotlight, it can make a lot of sense for them to stay outside of the spotlight and avoid those negative repercussions. On the other hand, we didn't see this working for anybody to get them promotions, to get them raises, or to really advance their careers. It was really a strategy that was most effective for maintaining stability.
And this isn't just a workplace problem. It's also related to what we expect of women in the context of family and the home. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one example that was really striking to us was a woman who had two young kids at home and a husband. And when she had had her second child, she decided she'd go back to work at 75% time. She didn't find this satisfying, though. She was finding that she wasn't getting assigned to such interesting projects now that she wasn't full-time. And she was still really carrying a full-time workload. She was just getting less pay and fewer rewards for it. So she wanted to go back to work full-time, but she felt like, in her words, she needed to acclimate her husband. At the same time, her husband was actually working freelance. He was working from home most of the time and had a really flexible schedule. But she still felt like she didn't want to limit his chances to really make a great career move and start earning more money and working full-time for a new company. So she didn't shift household responsibilities onto him. She told us, and we thought this is funny and also a bit sad, that her husband's per capita rate of income would be really high in theory if he actually got a job.
Yeah, I my understanding is often freelance is another word for unemployed. We have some callers. Let's take some of those. Tyra is with us in La Crosse. Tyra, thanks for joining us on the morning show this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead. Tell us your story.
Go ahead.
That's okay. I was just telling you to go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, well, fine. My thing is, I work in healthcare. I'm a nurse, and I've seen the same thing. It's female-dominated, but if you're considered, if you stand up or you're too vocal or you're too, I guess you would say a strong personality, it's the same thing. You will be beat back down either by upper management, which is very male-dominated, or middle management, which are nurses, which, again, will hold you back because they want, I don't even want to use the term meek, but they want kind of yes people in those roles.
What, Devin, what, is this, does Tyra's story strike any bells for you in terms of what you found in your study? Is this, did you find this only happening in male-dominated workplaces, or as Tyra's describing it, in female-dominated workplaces, the same thing happens?
I think Tyra is spot on. This is something we saw happening across divisions of the organization we studied. So some were male-dominated, like IT services, for example, and some that were more kind of development or fundraising divisions were female-dominated, but the same things were happening. One thing that Tyra brings up is that often even in female-dominated divisions of a company, the upper management are still men, and so with regards to promotion, that matters a lot. But even on teams that are predominantly women, everybody is still tuned into the same gender stereotype. And so even in those contexts, people might find you unlikable if, as a woman, you speak up or have a strong personality, like Tyra described. We actually spoke with one person who was a fundraiser, and most of her colleagues were women, but she said she saw people all the time who were passed over for promotions because they were seen as not having a sense of the big picture or kind of not being likable members of the team. So she'd been practicing very intentionally to learn to cover up more, to shut her mouth once in a while, as she put it. And ultimately, she decided it wasn't even worth her time to look for promotions. She just decided to find ways to make her current position feel rewarding so that she could avoid the negativity that happened when she spoke up too much.
Tyra, thanks for your call. Let's go to Sarah next, also from La Crosse. I guess it's a La Crosse morning here on the Ideas Network. Sarah, welcome to the morning show. What's your story?
Yes, good morning. What really caught me in the conversation is the spousal support. Currently, I am working my way through school. I am doing a management internship, and I don't think I would be able to do this without support from my spouse. When I decided to take on this new role, he was 100% behind me and told me to do whatever I wanted to do. And he's there to take care of the things at home and the kids when I'm not there.
Well, Sarah, that sounds like an ideal situation. Devin Magliosi?
That does sound great. I'm very happy to hear that that's going well for you. I think if more families had situations like that, it would absolutely free women up to take riskier moves at work and more reach projects or bigger moves, since they would be freed up not to take on an extra burden at home.
Sarah, thanks sharing your story with us. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Intentional invisibility. Women, does this resonate with you? Have you practiced this where you work? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. Let's take another call. Chad is with us from Columbus. Chad, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good so far, but the day is young. What's your story?
Well, my story is more of a question, and I apologize if this was covered because I got here later, but was this study, does it include any maybe career information or geographical information? Because I may have just be an oddity out here and have gotten lucky, but in the mechanical, electronic, and electrical engineering segments that I've worked in here for the last, 15 or 20 years, I've been surrounded by some very powerful women in supervisory or leadership roles, and my perception of them was actually very positive. So I'm not sure if I'm an oddity in this, or if this is my geographical location, or if it's the career path that I've chosen. Maybe I missed that part, but I'm not seeing the intentional invisibility, rather the other hand in my case here, and I think it's very refreshing to have women in positions of leadership and supervisory that are assertive.
All right, Chad, thank you for sharing that with us. Devin, what do you think about what Chad had to say?
Well, I hope that that is what's happening in Chad's workplace and in various workplaces across the country. I think we want to see organizations that are really valuing women who are assertive and who are speaking up, and there are absolutely exceptions to the rule. The organization that we studied, I'm not able to name, but it was a large organization on the West Coast in a pretty liberal area that is pretty cognizant about gender inequality, and we did still see this happening. One of the things to be aware of is that since women are trying not to rock the boat, they're trying not to raise issues, they might be stepping out of the spotlight without anybody noticing it. In some ways, that's the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to assume that that's everybody's experience. It absolutely isn't, and we saw exceptions even within our study. But in a lot of cases, women might be stepping back without the colleagues around them noticing.
Devin Magliosi, we need to take a break for news. We'll come back and we'll talk some more about your study and hear some more stories. We've got some more callers lined up. You could be next at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Intentional invisibility is a workplace strategy often adopted by women, according to a new study. We're talking with one of the researchers who looked into this behavior and wondering if this idea resonates with you. Tell us your workplace stories. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Devin Magliosi, PhD candidate in sociology at Stanford University and co-author of the study Intentional Invisibility, Professional Women and the Navigation of Workplace Constraints. The how much of this involves Devin? How much of this involves how we are culturally programmed by gender? How much of that plays in? Is that a factor in your study, or is that something that you've thought about?
Yes, of course. Part of this is how men and women are taught to behave over a lifetime of socialization. And part of this is also how gender stereotypes are baked into organizations. So some women might feel uncomfortable being very assertive because their entire lives they've faced a negative response when they've acted that way and have been taught to take up less space and to be a bit more passive. Some women, though, are perfectly comfortable being assertive, but the way that supervisors or team members or organizational evaluations will characterize that is negative because it violates their expectations about how a woman should behave. So it's really partly about changing expectations in a broad societal sense about how men and women should act, and also changing concrete things within organizations like how evaluations are performed, so that there's more gender equality.
Let's take a call. Well, we need to get one set up first. 800-642-1234. We had somebody I was going to take, and then they dropped off. That's unfortunate. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our program. This conversation sort of begs the question, should women be adapting to workplaces that value stereotypically masculine behaviors, or should workplaces be adapting to make it easier for women to lead and get promoted? In other words, is it really fair to tell women to be more confident and assertive and just go for what they want when they're not socialized to behave that way? And, I mean, we've talked about this. I just don't know that we can emphasize it enough, because that seems to be part of the crux of this whole thing.
Yes, and my colleagues and I come down firmly on the side that it's organizations that need to change. Some women are already very comfortable being assertive, and a lot of women already feel very confident in their skills and abilities at work, but they still face backlash when they actually act that way because it violates expectations. So we need organizations that, on the one hand, make it easier for women to take on visible positions and limit backlash when they do, and on the other hand, that change the criteria that are rewarded in a leader so that what it means to be a good leader isn't defined only in stereotypically masculine terms, like assertiveness.
Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of emphasis on leadership skills. There are leadership programs that are promoted at various institutions. There are communities that have leadership programs, and both men and women can go through these. They can learn about leadership traits and how to be leaders where they are, and they're not just at work but in their communities. Leadership is something that's really, really valued, supposedly. But it seems to me, from listening to you talk about what you found in your study, that isn't necessarily how things play out in the workplace, at least as not as far as women are concerned. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. Sometimes when women take on the characteristics that are associated in a conventional sense with good leadership, they're seen as too aggressive, rude, pushy, abrasive. Those kinds of negative characteristics are ascribed to them.
Yeah, and you know, that characterization is troubling to me in some ways, because the way I've been trained to perceive leadership is that it's not just about dominate. It's not about being dominant. It's actually about it's actually more the leader as servant, about taking care of the people who are being led rather than telling them what to do. Maybe I'm having a disconnect with what I there's a disconnect between what I see as leadership and what actually takes place.
It is possible that in different sectors or different industries that there are different expectations about leadership, but what studies have shown in sectors including large nonprofits and for-profit corporations, is that when people are actually evaluated for promotions or for leadership positions, being seen as a person who's assertive or confident is really important, but it's described with positive terms for men and negative terms for women.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Anna is with us in Madison. Anna, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
So I'm a park ranger, and I guess what I see in my field a lot is not so much the voluntary invisibility as kind of an involuntary erasure. People, or women specifically, get kind of talked over and just kind of ignored in my field so often that you kind of accept that that's the way it is and just go about doing your job because that's the reality. For instance, my boss did a lot of relief work in Texas, disaster relief, and she would run chainsaws every day. And when she came back, our all-male field crew still tried to explain to her how to use one pretty consistently. And just the other day, I was in full uniform with my other boss, who is a man, and one of our guests asked first if I was his son, and then upon figuring out I was a woman, if I was his wife, because she couldn't seem to understand that I would work for an organization as a park ranger.
Anna, thanks for sharing your story. We only have about a minute left. How typical is this, Devin?
It's quite typical. I'm very glad you brought that up, Anna. We saw an example where a boss organized a cleanup party for the office and invited everybody to come clean up the space, but only women showed up, and the boss himself didn't even bother to show up. So we see women trying to come up with coping strategies and ways of explaining away moments where they are rendered invisible and really overlooked by superiors in the workplace.
Okay. Devin Magliosi, thanks for being with us and sharing the results of your research today. I really appreciate your time, and this was fascinating work, and I hope something comes of it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Devin Magliosi is a PhD candidate in sociology at Stanford University, co-author of the study Intentional Invisibility, Professional Women and the Navigation of the Workplace. School districts across Wisconsin are seeing their enrollment decline. In Milwaukee, the drop is due in part to fewer school-aged children, but the growing popularity of the state's voucher program that helps some families pay for schools has also, for private schools, has also played a role. As Jimena Condi reports, Milwaukee Public Schools is trying a new recruitment tactic this summer, but whether it can better market its schools remains to be seen.
A high school drumline plays for a crowd of more than 100 people in front of MPS headquarters. On this June morning, Keith Posley, acting head of the district, is launching a first-of-its-kind student enrollment campaign.
Go to doors and explain to family members the love and all of the great things that are happening in the Milwaukee Public Schools.
A couple of hours later, Tom Bruno, principal of U.S. Grant Elementary, is trying to do just that in the school's surrounding neighborhood.
Good morning. How are you?
Bruno and five other canvassers are going door to door, ready to extol the virtues of public schools like Grant. Bruno can rattle off the ways students there get a well-rounded education.
Last year, we started musical theater with our middle school group. They did Hamilton, Hairspray, and High School Musical together. They did these medleys. The parents just loved it. You know, we offer art, we offer PE.
But U.S. Grant is not the only school vying for students.
Two blocks away, we have St. Raphael's, and they have two school buildings. We have the new St. Augustine. We have St. Anthony's.
This year, MPS reported enrollment at less than 78,000 students. That's down from 97,000 in 2003. That's meant fewer state dollars for a district strapped for funds. Some funding that could have gone to MPS now follows 28,000 students that use vouchers to attend private schools. It's likely several of those students could be going to U.S. Grant. Bruno says he understands why parents would make that choice.
5 years ago, we were on the failing list.
Grant students were underperforming in reading and math compared to the state average. And while students at Grant are now performing better than the overall district, Bruno says some parents may not know. But at a block party at St. Anthony's, one of Bruno's competitors, families say they opted into the voucher program based on more than academic performance.
You can, you know, participate more without being afraid to ask questions or just like that motivation that the teacher provides for you.
That's Daniela Garcia. She made the switch to private school after the fourth grade. Now in high school, Daniela says she loved the smaller class sizes. Her mother, Elvira, says she was sold on the culture.
Que a nosotros nos hacen parte.
They make us part of that mindset that university is possible for everyone. But I learned that with the education and the information they gave me at the school.
Annabelle Macias says the extracurricular activities offered influenced her choice, as did religion.
Because it's Catholic, and I'm 100% Catholic, and because they use uniforms too.
The Cleveland Metropolitan School District has been where MPS finds itself. The district's enrollment dropped to less than 35,000 students in 2011, an almost 50% loss from 2002. Rick McIntosh oversees enrollment for Cleveland Metropolitan. He says to stop the decline, his district has had to embrace the idea that parents have options.
We have to really understand that we are changing the culture.
Cleveland tried a door-to-door enrollment effort, but it wasn't enough on its own. In 2012, the district launched a set of school reforms that included creating more magnet high schools and expanding pre-K for four-year-olds. Then the district launched a campaign to inform parents of the changes. McIntosh says it aims to get parents to look past the district's shortcomings.
So that makes families really consider us an option to come to or to stay within.
Since then, enrollment has increased by about 5%. MPS already does some types of community outreach, like high school and career fairs, and has seen enrollment increase by almost 2,000 students, or almost 3%, in 2 years. But whether the door-to-door enrollment campaign will build on that success remains to be seen. On the day of its launch, Bruno's group failed to enroll a single student. Ximena Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Up next on the morning show, we'll talk with political hopefuls who want to be the state's next treasurer. Plus, we'll learn about changes to insurance rates for Wisconsinites who buy coverage on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network.